From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by a great group of people who love State of Belief Radio, think we ought to be on the air, and they give us money to keep us there. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. And if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep the show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Thursday is the American Interfaith Observance of Thanksgiving. And November 24th brings the Sikh observance of the martyrdom of Guru Tegh Bahadur. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Bullying is not religious expression. These kids were not thinking about their love for their church when they were tormenting me. They were doing this because they thought it was entertaining.
It's been impossible not to notice how many adults have come to behave like schoolyard bullies in recent months and years. Whether it's online attacks or personal hostility and even assault, civility is in pretty awful shape in many parts of our society right now, which only makes things even worse in the actual schoolyard. Stepping up to address that last problem is the organization American Muslim Health Professionals, which is organizing the first national interfaith anti-bullying summit in Washington, D.C. We'll get details from Dr. Muna Chaudhry, Director of Mental Health Programming at AMHP.
Can you be spiritual and not be religious?
Yes.
You can be both?
Yes.
So they don't have to converge?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I say that because there's wonderful people who have spiritual experiences on their horses
right. On
Sunday morning.
Uh-huh. We've been keeping a close eye for years on the rapid growth of the nuns in this country. Americans who do not subscribe to any particular formal religion, although many consider themselves to be deeply spiritual. That last group has just received comprehensive study from the respected Public Religion Research Institute, and there are plenty of important findings to explore. This week, we'll do just that with PRRI CEO Dr. Robert P. Jones. But first...
Clearly. Can he speak for himself, please?
Judge,
you're running for Senate. Speak, please.
I paid for the microphone. I'm sorry.
Are your accusers lying?
Yes, sir. Do you have a question about an issue?
That's the issue right
you're
now.
You're insinuating that which just simply can't be true. You simply cannot fake the being a godly, a true, a trustworthy, a valiant leader on the principles of the Bible. You cannot fake that.
He can help drain the slimy swamp, which is inhabited by cowardly rhinos, communist Democrats, greedy lobbyists, and the alt-left lackeys in the press.
He stands on the premise that when you come to take our rights, you spit in the face of God. And that is why they hate him.
It's an ugly story that just keeps getting uglier. After decades of fomenting hostility between conservative Christians and alleged enemies, Democrats, secular Americans, LGBT persons, the U.S. Constitution, and so many others, disgraced Alabama Judge Roy Moore has only seen his support for U.S. Senate grow among likely evangelical voters, even as the accusations against him multiply. Now, at the same time, the Moore campaign has been promoting endorsements from law enforcement leaders who have turned around and denied endorsing him. And most recently, several faith leaders listed as endorsers have also said their names were used without permission to safely delve into this toxic swamp. I'm joined by an expert guide, Think Progress senior religion reporter Jack Jenkins. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
I know you've been keeping a close eye on this Roy Moore fiasco. It's going to be really hard for me to get through this interview without speculating that we now know the reason Moore desperately needed a monument to the Ten Commandments at his courtroom, that it was the only way he could remember them. But I will do my best not to speculate about all of that, even a little bit.
All right.
With that out of the way, Jack, I also have to say that we're taping this interview on Thursday, and the average daily number of accusers against Moore lately has been around 1.5. So by the time this is broadcast, a lot may have happened, but probably right. not the level of support the disgraced judge is enjoying from the evangelical Christians in Alabama. Why is it so bulletproof?
That's a really good question, and I will say I wish we had more polling on this. We had one poll that came out. There was a section of evangelicals who said they were more likely to vote for Moore because of these allegations. So there's clearly this group that he latches onto, and he might be hemorrhaging his support, but I think a lot of the reason that you see some of these Alabama conservative Christians continuing to rally around him. In many ways, Roy Moore is a distilled version of Christian nationalism in its really purest form. I mean, he's made his career off of campaigning for this idea that America is a Christian nation, that it needs to be very publicly expressive of that. You know, he's lost his job for refusing to remove statues commemorating the Ten Commandments from government buildings, which is a violation of the Establishment Clause. He's become a folk hero among Christian nationalists for his hardline position advocating for this fusion of patriotism and national identity and faith. But the thing about that is what you often find when you dig deep into Christian nationalism is that, well, people like Moore often will wrap them around in a specific theology. They'll cite scripture, et cetera, to kind of justify it. Mm-hmm. It often functions less as a consistent or often inconsistent theology and more as an identity. It's how you see yourself if you are impacted by Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. Christian nationalism cuts across other groups, but particularly white evangelicals who find solace in the idea that America is a Christian nation, they're willing to forgive other things. As long as they're able to hold on to this identity that they grasp onto. And one thing I'll note is, you know, I spoke to some experts about this, and in 2016, when white evangelicals flocked to Donald Trump on Election Day, some people were surprised by this idea that evangelicals would suddenly rally behind someone whose background is you know, at best morally questionable, mm-hmm. right? And in terms of their personal behavior, in terms of Donald Trump's personal behavior. And when I talked to Jeff Charlotte, who's an academic mm-hmm. and author, he told me, you know, the idea that evangelical Christians think that their politicians need to be moral exemplars is kind of a new idea. Like Ralph Reed started pushing that, you know, head of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, mm-hmm. a big paragon of the religious right, you know, blasted Bill Clinton in the 1990s, you know, calling for moral mm-hmm. superiority in public figures and politicians, but he was singing a very different tune when it came to Donald Trump in 2016. And Charlotte noted that that's more of the norm historically for this group, that they kind of pick and choose when to be outraged by behavior rather than adhering to this consistent idea that politicians need to be one sort of person. So when it comes to Roy Moore, you have two things going on at once. One, that Christian nationalism means that the identity is arguably more important than any accusation. And two, evangelicals are willing to kind of overlook behavior sometimes, mm-hmm. historically, even when it's a politician that is supposed to be a paragon of Christian virtue.
Well, Jack, honestly, what would it take for these supposedly value-soaked supporters to consider withdrawing their support from Moore?
I think that's an excellent question. It's not immediately clear. I mean, one would think you could speculate about whatever proof, quote unquote, they would require for this. I don't know if you get more than, you know, all of these accusers or the fact that Moore was reportedly banned from a mall when he was younger and that a whole many residents of the town have corroborated that report. But I will note something that I heard about recently where Rush Limbaugh, obviously an old school participant in the right wing media, one of the things he came out and said earlier this week was that those things that Roy Moore did when he was younger, in his 30s, dating teenagers allegedly and allegedly sexually assaulting minors, and the whole incident where he was reportedly banned from a mall, those all happened, according to Rush Limbaugh, when he was a Democrat. And similar things were said about Donald Trump, when people would say, well, he held positions that are antithetical to the Republican Party in the past, but that was when he was a Democrat. And so what you start to hear is that it's more about this tribal identity, that if Roy Moore switched parties tomorrow, he might hemorrhage support. Or if he left the Republican Party and claimed something else, even if it wasn't a Democrat, then he might fall outside of these two binary categories that seem to be driving so many individuals. But yeah, honestly, in terms of individual behavior, there hasn't been indications yet that any one particular claim or even evidence is going to dissuade this group, this demographic, in large numbers. Now, as you note, it's possible that it could dissuade enough of them. One thing to remember is that while evangelicals only make up around 17%, according to PRRI, of the American populace, white evangelical Protestants, that is, and they make up, you know, around 30-ish percent of the Republican Party, they make up 58% of the Republican Party in Alabama. And white evangelical Protestants often vote higher than just their raw population percentage. So he has to hemorrhage a lot of them to lose. But maybe this kind of stuff would pull off enough for Doug Jones, his Democratic opponent, to win. But I don't think there's a clear answer to your question.
Yeah. Is there anything to the fact that his accusers are women?
I certainly think, I would say that this is something that transcends just evangelicalism. I think sexism is absolutely a component of why accusers are often not believed when women call out men for these sorts of things. I mean, the counter argument that's often lobbed by Roy Moore's campaign is in Roy Moore's supporters is, well, you know, these people, why did they wait so long to come out? And the response to that often is, well, they don't come out because they're afraid this would happen, that people would tell them that they're liars. And I do think that there's some systemic sexism in why women are not believed often when they make these kinds of accusations, and why suddenly in the court of public opinion, as opposed to the court of law, there's this inherent skepticism when women claim that men have done things. And I do think there's certain elements of conservatism that tend to prop up patriarchy and sexism, but I don't think that's exclusive to the right in any regard.
Yeah. Well, Sean Hannity and other rabid Moore boosters have started to speak out in recent days against the Senate candidate. Do you give any credence to the theory that engineering a way for Jeff Sessions to run for his old seat from Alabama would clear the way for a more compliant attorney general?
I mean, I would be surprised if he took people up on that offer. I mean, I think in my read of the race, he would be one of the few candidates who could jump into that race and win it. I think he would have enough support in the state of Alabama to pull that off. So I think that's one of the reasons he would be flagged as a good person to, you know, run. I'm doubtful that any of that's going to happen for a few reasons. One, that Roy Moore has forged his career off of not doing what people tell him to do. And, you know, he lost his job even at the direction of federal judges, you know, saying that you need to remove the statue of the Ten Commandments, and he was gladly removed from office, gladly on his part, in defiance of them. So I don't really see, I would be more surprised if he left than if he stayed. And I also think for all of the controversy that, you know, the current attorney general likes, Jeff Sessions likes to remain the current attorney general. But I'm sure there are people in the Trump camp who would like to see that kind of trade. Yeah. We've certainly heard a lot of palace intrigue stories about how the attorney general and the president are often at odds with one another. And that, you know, as the Russia investigations go on. You know, he may or may not be a liability to the administration. But one of the problems I often have with those kinds of theories is they imply a deep level of competence that I'm not sure is always there
yes.
in any federal government. And so I think there are certainly folks who would like to see that. I'm not sure that's what's going to happen.
I see. I want to ask for your thoughts on this assault on the Johnson Amendment that we've seen in the Republican tax plan.
Well, I mean, it's certainly still there, certainly a thing. You know, as we saw, there have been multiple attempts throughout the year to kind of chip away at this part of our tax plan that prohibits nonprofits in general and in specificity faith groups from, you know, basically standing at the front of their pulpit and endorsing a candidate on behalf of their church as opposed to as an individual. And it seems like Republicans really want this, and they keep trying to figure out ways to push this. What's weird is that it's not a very popular idea. Polls show that majorities of every major faith group oppose further politicizing churches, and that includes white evangelical Protestants. White evangelical Protestants also do not support this idea. You know, I've talked to some tax experts who've noted that one of the big concerns here is not just that it would be pastors endorsing from the pulpit, but that if pastors were allowed to do that, if they were allowed to be completely involved in a campaign and still maintain their tax-exempt status, because that's what this is really about when we talk about the Johnson Amendment. Mm-hmm. It's about you would lose your tax-exempt status right now, technically, on the books, although it's rarely enforced mm-hmm. if you endorse from the pulpit. But if they were allowed to do that, it might turn their churches into what effectively works as a new kind of super PAC. Mm-hmm. Because why would you donate to a campaign, give a donation that is not tax deductible, when you could donate to a mega church with a large pastor that's participating in a campaign that would be a tax deductible donation? And so it would kind of allow a different version of dark money to operate within our political sphere. It, right now, you know, how much pushback it actually gets in these sorts of bills when people often don't know that they're in there and that they don't have a lot of very vocal advocates calling for their removal, it's very possible that Congress could figure out a way to slip this through. Yeah. And the current thing that, you know, that they've introduced in the tax plan would not totally gut the Johnson Amendment, but certainly chip away at it. And that seems to be the slow-moving strategy at this point.
Jack Jenkins is senior religion reporter at Think Progress. We'll link to his excellent reporting on Christian nationalism, Donald Trump, and Roy Moore from stateofbelief.com. Jack, thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you all for having me on.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Robbie Jones will be back with details of an eye-opening new Public Religion Research Institute study of spiritual but not religious Americans. And later, the first ever National Interfaith Anti-Bullying Summit with Muna Chaudhry. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Even as the disproportionate impact on our state and federal policies from the political religious right keeps grabbing our attention, there continues to be growth in the ranks of the religiously unaffiliated. A comprehensive look at this sizable segment of our population has just appeared under the headline, Searching for Spirituality in the U.S., A New Look at the Spiritual but Not Religious. It comes from the Public Religion Research Institute, and I'm happy to be joined by PRRI founding CEO, Dr. Robert P. Jones. Robbie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, Welton. Glad to be back with you.
Before we get to any actual findings, I wish you would start by simply summarizing the four groups that you sorted respondents into.
Well, I mean, we did start with all of the, you know, news and conversations that we have been having in the country around this group that's kind of got called the spiritual but not religious group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is maybe people who aren't formally affiliated with religion still retain a kind of interest in spirituality. Becoming more important as more and more, particularly young people, are not affiliated. And basically what we did is we decided to take two dimensions. One of those dimensions is religiosity. And we, you know, we're doing quantitative measurements, so we have to come up with some way of measuring that. And we, in this study, measured religiosity by religious attendance and how important someone said religion was in their life. So they scored higher or lower on those two measures. And then the trickier one was trying to figure out, you know, how to measure something as amorphous as spirituality. Mm-hmm. There's lots of ways of doing this. Certainly, this is not the only one. But what we did is we, out of a battery of eight questions, we found three that really held together very well and expressed a certain aspect of spirituality. And basically, the aspect we're measuring here is people who said they felt particularly connected to the world around them, who felt like they were part of something much bigger than themselves, and felt a sense of larger meaning and purpose in life. So that's kind of how we measure spirituality. And then we basically, you know, crossed these two things and came up with four groups by crossing these two dimensions against each other. And the first one is the one we spent the most time on, is the spiritual but not religious group. So that's people who were basically scored higher on that spirituality index than the average person, but lower on the religious index. And then we had the group that was both spiritual and religious, who scored high on both. A group down on the other end, neither spiritual nor religious, who scored low on both. And then a group that's kind of interesting, I may end up doing some more work on, because it's not what anyone really talks about, but people who actually are not spiritual but religious. That is, they scored fairly low on the spirituality index but higher on the religiosity measures. But the report itself focuses on that first group, the spiritual but not religious group, just because there's been so much conjecture about who this group is and how they relate to the growing number of unaffiliated people in the country.
I was shocked by which group wound up being the biggest. Talk about that group for a moment, if you would.
Yeah, so in the American religious landscape, out of those four groups, there's some symmetry, really, that the largest group is actually the neither spiritual nor religious group, people who scored low on both. That makes up 31% of the country. But nearly as big is the spiritual and religious. So the two bookends group make up about 6 in 10 Americans, right? So that group is 29% of the group. So you put those two together, and that's, you know, most of the country is either spiritual and religious, or they're neither spiritual nor religious. What that tells you is that in the American religious landscape, on the whole, these things hang together. If you are spiritual, you're likely to be religious, and vice versa. And then the other two groups, 22% is the not spiritual but religious, and 18% is the spiritual but not religious group.
Mm-hmm. Do your four groups comprise what we have called nones, N-O-N-E-S?
We deliberately left out religious affiliation from the measure because we wanted to be able to take these measures and look at religious affiliation by these measures. We were actually a little bit surprised because I think often when we talk about religiously unaffiliated Americans, that is Americans who claim no formal religion, when you ask them, what is your religion? Are you Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, you know, Hindu, Buddhist, other? They say nothing in particular, or they say they're atheists or agnostic. So they explicitly will not claim one of the kind of traditional religious groups. Mm-hmm. And again, that group is about a quarter of the country today. You know, going in, my hunch was that a fairly large segment of that group would be this spiritual but not religious. And we were actually surprised to find that only about 3 in 10 of that group could be categorized as spiritual but not religious. And overwhelmingly, 2/3 of that group actually fell into the more secular group, the neither spiritual nor religious. So that was, I think, one of the surprising findings. I thought that we would see a bigger subgroup among unaffiliated folks that would be spiritual but not religious.
Take a minute, if you will, to describe any denominations that stand out for how much or how little they are represented in the four groups.
Yeah, you know, what's notable, I mean, I mentioned this very interesting group of people who didn't score very high, not spiritual, but religious. I kind of start with that one because it's interesting to me that one of the things that we found is that Catholics actually ended up scoring higher on that measure than many other groups did. And we basically think that part of what's going on there is that it's a kind of ethnic connection to religion, so that the spirituality component may or may not be there, but still there's other ways of connecting to religion. When you look at the other religious groups, the two groups that score highest and have both high measures of spirituality and religiosity are white evangelical Protestants. So the majority of them actually fall into that category of scoring high on both measures. And African-American Protestants, about half of whom, score fairly high on that measure. And the white mainline Protestant group is pretty interesting because the biggest subset of that group is actually neither spiritual nor religious. So among white mainline Protestants, there are more people who say, I'm neither spiritual nor religious, yet still identify as white mainline Protestant than any other religious group.
Hmm. We're talking about PRRI's new report titled Searching for Spirituality in the U.S., A New Look at the Spiritual but Not Religious. So what's the demographic makeup of religiously unaffiliated Americans, and does that segment have something that makes it stand out?
Yeah, you know, we're seeing this is clearly driven by younger people. That is the move away from traditional religiosity. So very much overpopulated by younger people. It's a pretty diverse group. You know, so the average age is much younger than the general population. And that's true however they score on the spirituality scale. The marker for formal religiosity is very much generational. So the younger you are, the more likely you're to score lower on the kind of religiosity scale, and the older you are, the more likely you are to score higher on that dimension of the scale.
You know, people have typically challenged reports on the nuns by saying that as people get older, they usually get more religious. But there are problems with that dismissive response, aren't there?
Yeah, you know, it's always been true, and still remains true to some extent, that there is some return, you know, of maybe think about the prodigal son or something story from the Bible, you know, but that people in their 20s, you know, they're very mobile. They tend to be maybe working a couple of jobs or moving around a lot. They haven't settled down, gotten married, had kids. Mm-hmm. And every generation in their 20s is more unaffiliated than they are in their older generations. But the best piece of evidence is if you look at the generational differences, you take baby boomers, for example, and put them back into their 20s, we can actually look back at the data. They're still much less unaffiliated in their 20s than this current generation is today. So that there's about 4 in 10 of the under 30 crowd that claims no religious affiliation. So even if similar kinds of proportions return to religiosity in their 30s that they grew up with, they will still be the most unaffiliated generation we've ever seen. And the other caveat to that is that we now are at a place where we are beginning to see a second generation of people who were actually raised without a religious affiliation, right? So there's actually nowhere for that group to return to. They grew up with no religious affiliation. And that's something that we, no previous generation to this one, has ever had sizable numbers of people who were raised non-religious.
Yeah. Did you ask members of the four groups that you sorted respondents into why they believe as they believe? Is organized religion repelling them, or is non-affiliation attracting them?
It's a good question. We didn't ask in this study, but we have asked in previous studies about this question. And particularly among young people, what we hear, the most of the thing we hear is that they've simply stopped believing some of the doctrines or the teachings of the religion, or that they've become just not that relevant to their lives. And for those people, I think it really is about relevance. It's less about anger and rejection and more about just, it's just not relevant. The other thing that does stand out, though, is when we've asked people about kind of the political arena, that about a third of those who were raised religious and left, and by the way, most of them leave by the time they're 20, so it's not a college thing, it's a pre-college thing for most of them. What they say, that about a third of them have said that negative teachings about gay and lesbian people or negative treatment of gay and lesbian people were an important reason why they left.
Hmm. Robbie, what did you find regarding life satisfaction?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the more interesting things. We had a set of measures on the study that measured just self-reported life satisfaction, both in general and in some specifics. Interestingly enough, we found that it was the spirituality dimension, not the religious dimension so much, that drove people's life satisfaction. So we've basically found a correlation between higher levels of spirituality being correlated with higher life satisfaction across a whole range of measures. 6 in 10, those who say they're spiritual but not religious, and 7 in 10 who say they're spiritual and religious say they're very or completely satisfied with their lives overall. But if you look at the groups that are not spiritual, only 53% who are not spiritual but religious, and only 47% of those who are neither spiritual or religious say the same thing. So there's a statistically significant difference that mostly hinges around this kind of relationship between higher levels of spirituality and higher life satisfaction. The other thing we had measures on is what we dubbed kind of pro-social behavior, that is kind of, you know, just acting in civil and kind ways to people. And also their, you know, spirituality played a role, that people who identified as spiritual were much more likely to do things like, say, they've done a personal favor for a friend or coworker, or they've allowed someone to cut ahead of them in line. I mean, just kind of very simple but daily tasks. And, you know, I think many of us are, you know, feeling, you know, all the coarseness in the culture and shootings and the world is feeling in many ways, you know, charges of sexual harassment and a very uncivil place. And, you know, at least according to the data here, a little more spirituality would correlate with, you know, just a civic space that is just more congenial, I think, and civil.
Robbie, when you look at this, the whole picture, what do you say to yourself? What does this tell you?
Yeah, well, I'll go back to the kind of democracy point. I mean, one of the things, I think you and I have talked about this before, that, you know, I do have some, you know, worries about just from a kind of healthy democratic society point is that, you know, churches and synagogues, you know, mosques and other religious congregations have typically served as an entry point to civic engagement in the country, from everything from voting to volunteering at the soup kitchen to, you know, donating money to charity or volunteering at charities. And, you know, as these more traditional institutions are waning and losing members, and those, it's worth noting that, you know, historically, spirituality and religiosity have been highly correlated and remain so. So it does mean that as those institutions are being challenged and in many cases weakened or even dying, those places as conduits not only of spirituality but as conduit specific engagement, I think, should be a worry for everyone. Like, and it raises the real question of what is going to be the incubator then of a sense of connectedness, to, you know, solidarity and connectedness, not only to one another but to nature and, you know, the world we live in, and what's going to be the catalyst for volunteering and for voting and other kinds of, you know, social behaviors that kind of help make the country what it is. I think that's a real question going forward, is what's going to spring up in its place. And if nothing does, I think we may lose a significant amount of social capital here.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. We've only scratched the surface of the comprehensive new report titled Searching for Spirituality in the U.S., A New Look at the Spiritual But Not Religious. I encourage you to spend some time with this material at PRRI.org. Robbie, I am so grateful to have you with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Wilton. It's always good to be back with you.
As differences among Americans are exploited by some to worsen divisions for nakedly political purposes, all too often it's kids who are paying the highest price. Biases and hatreds are empowered, and incidents of bullying and worse multiply. Stepping up to challenge what is becoming an epidemic in some parts of this country is the organization American Muslim Health Professionals, which has organized the first national interfaith anti-bullying summit. It's happening December 2nd and 3rd in Washington, D.C. And I am joined now by Dr. Muna Chaudhry, Director of Mental Health Programming at AMHP. Muna, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Wilton. It's great to be with you today.
Is the focus of this event only religion-based bullying, or is it broader than that?
So the focus of our event is religious-based bullying and also including anyone who's targeted because of their faith beliefs and not necessarily just their religion, but anyone who believes in certain beliefs relating to their faith.
Mm-hmm. Would you expand a bit on just how big the problem of bullying has become?
So we have seen that the rise of bullying incidents have been centered more so around culture and faith in the last year to 2 years around the country. There are statistics that actually Muslim students, that 51% approximately of Muslim students are targeted based on their religious background or faith beliefs. We've also found a much higher increase in Sikh students, Hindu students, and other students who have different types of religious beliefs being targeted based on their religion. So in the last 2 years, all schools have reported an increase according to government statistics. The government has actually included a response form for people to report those complaints on their education website.
You have some very compelling speakers lined up for the weekend of December 2-3. Would you talk about some of those speakers that are going to be there?
Sure. We are going to be hearing from a keynote speaker that has actually experienced bullying for much of his youth and has written about his experiences. He will open up our summit so we can really understand the effects on an individual. But from there, we will have researchers from across the country that have done more in-depth analysis of the effects of bullying and what types of interventions work. We have people from the Religious Freedom Center. We have people from universities who have done that work and have seen that religious literacy programs are lacking, and hopefully we'll be able to present some of the needs of how to educate our teachers, our students, and anyone who isn't around children who talk about religion or faith and the differences that are involved. So we will have those people. We will also be hearing from bullying victims themselves. Mm-hmm. We will have two individuals who have suffered the effects of bullying in their school settings discuss the narrative of their experience and to be able to have a conversation with them for our presenters. As we know, the personal experience of victims is really important to incorporate into any type of learning program. And from there, we'll also be having people on the second day who are from the Hindu communities, the Sikh communities, Mormon communities, and as well as Islamic communities, talk about their work in their individual organizations. So some of these speakers are people who have been working in this area for years and are finally able to share it with other partners from other faiths.
Whom are you targeting most directly with this first-of-its-kind anti-bullying summit? Who do you want in the audience?
So we are looking to include anyone from a teacher to an activist. So we are looking for teachers, students, advocates, educators, administrators, health professionals that work in counseling or mental health, as well as youth activists to attend this summit. It is really open to so many different people because the truth is that so many different people and roles are involved in a situation where bullying or faith-based bullying is occurring, and that goes from the institution down to the individuals, down to the victims and the people who are actually inciting bullying based on a people's faith. So we really need to involve all aspects of that. We really also hope for a good contingent of young people because we really feel that young people are the people who are going to take these ideas, interventions, and transform their schools and communities in the future.
Would you talk about the very real damage that bullying does to a child?
What we've seen is that the roots of bullying also connect to discrimination and prejudice, and it involves a lot of psychological processes. Some of this is just based in the idea of we versus them and the idea of being dominant over another group. And so this applies to faith-based bullying, just like it does in other areas. When kids experience that, not only are they experiencing the isolation of being different and learning that that's not tolerable, it also takes a considerable toll on their self-esteem and competence in the world. So the long-term effects last all the way through adulthood. If a child experiences bullying, feels isolated and alienated based on their faith, religion, they might start to think that there are other aspects of them that are not good enough for the larger society that they're living. And they carry that with them, and then perhaps many opportunities are lost to integrate them into the larger society. So this is really important when we try to build communities together. We try to increase the collaboration between faiths, but also between different groups that live together. So it really fosters further separation for individuals from society and further marginalization. And then, in terms of mental health, that type of experience can really relate to anxiety and depression as these children grow up, which really takes away opportunities to engage in education, in finding jobs, and being able to actually be productive members of society.
How can our listeners take part in this summit? Is it only in D.C., or are there some online ways to participate as well?
So you can participate, of course, by attending in person, but the other piece that you can do is you can download parts of the summit that will be recorded and will be available through the American Muslim Health Professionals website and YouTube. So we're going to be adding pieces of the videos. And we also, very importantly, at the end of the summit, will be publishing a white paper. And that white paper will comprise of recommendations, interventions, and solutions that have been established through this summit, through all the stakeholders, individuals, young people, teachers, educators that have attended through discussion groups and the drive to come up with solid solutions. That white paper will be available for anyone who's willing to download that at the end of the summit, and we will be publishing that with the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding.
Dr. Muna Chaudhry is Director of Mental Health Programming at American Muslim Health Professionals, which is organizing the first National Interfaith Anti-Bullying Summit on December 2nd and 3rd in Washington, D.C., and complete information is available at amhp.us. Muna, I am grateful for what you're doing in bringing people together for this important subject. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Walton. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Now, before we go, this week saw the passing at the age of 84 of the Reverend Dr. John Raines, an ordained Methodist minister, the son of a Methodist bishop. Dr. Raines quietly taught religion at Temple University in Philadelphia for 40 years. Last week also brought details of revelations that the Trump Justice Department has opened an incredible 27 investigations into leaks of information, triple the number that were underway 1 year ago. And that the FBI now has a special unit dealing specifically with unauthorized leaks. Now, here's why that's so ironic. In 1971, Dr. Raines, along with his wife Bonnie, participated in a daring break-in at an FBI office in Pennsylvania, grabbing documents that led to the establishment of the Church Commission and the exposure of the Bureau's notorious ContelPro initiative. It's because of this break-in that we know about J. Edgar Hoover's decades-long corruption and incredible secret influence on our leaders, about widespread illegal surveillance of American citizens, about Martin Luther King Jr. being urged by agents to kill himself to avoid having secrets of his private life exposed, and countless other terrifying stories. We owe a debt of gratitude to the Raineses and their co-conspirators. Few Americans would argue that it would have been better to not find out about the unconstitutional way a powerful federal agency was violating the rights of prominent and private citizens. But it took a small group of activists, including a Methodist minister and his wife, to get the evidence and submit it to three leading newspapers. The Washington Post alone was willing to publish the explosive story despite dire threats from Attorney General John N. Mitchell. And you can bet that the reluctance of other papers to initially join in the coverage was likely influenced by damaging information the FBI had about some of those making the decision not to publish. Dr. Raines knew they were taking a great risk. He and his wife made plans for the care of their three small children should they get caught. When the role he played in this plot came to light many years later, long after any statute of limitations had expired, Dr. Raines was criticized for pursuing a good cause in an illegal way. His unforgettable response was, "Those of us who were active in the civil rights movement of the early 60s had learned to differentiate between breaking a law and committing a crime." You know, it's something to keep in mind at a time when leakers are in the government's crosshairs, the press is maligned as fake news, and partisanship is at a fever pitch. Secrets are powerful things, and they are dangerous when in the hands of already powerful people, organizations, and governments. A free and independent press is and has always been a key counterweight to the schemes of the powerful and unaccountable, as have individuals, whether low-level bureaucrats, knowledgeable insiders, or even young, idealistic Methodist ministers. Rest in peace, Dr. Raines, and thank you so much. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please, please share that information with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Subscribe to the weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.